knife and turpentine, along with a box of charcoal and watercolours, squares of colour gone chalky with age. There's a leather roll which Joanna unfurls like a carpet. The top flap contains three unmarked vials, each full of shimmering powder in an opalescent blue the same shade as the shallows of the Mediterranean. Below, a whole row of vials, each containing a different substance, with their corks waxed shut. There are several missing, and one just a cracked rim and stopper clinging to its loop. I drag the lamp closer to me and squint at the vials. There is a word inked atop each, though most so small and cramped I can't make them out, except for one, which in clear block print reads Hemlock. It's a pouch of poisons, or rather, most likely all poisons. The top three vials with the crystal powder are the only thing that appears duplicated, and none of them have writing on their stoppers, though they're marked with the mathematical symbol for infinity, followed by a vertical line. I pop the stopper off one and sniff. It has a faint brine smell, like something collected from a beach. Sim's hardly breathing now, and each gasp shudders through her whole body. I can feel it in the places we touch each other, my legs around her waist and her hand cupped in mine. The edges of her lips and eyelids are beginning to tinge blue. Infinity what? I think desperately, staring down at the vial. Why infinity? Unless it's not infinity. I turn the vial horizontal to me, and the infinity is replaced by what looks like a number 8 crowned with a single stroke. It's an alchemical symbol, shorthand used by pharmacists and apothecaries, which I learned from Dante Robles in Barcelona. It means to digest. So this is not a poison. This may be an antidote. I pour the contents of the vial into my palm and press it to Sim's face. Her breath is slow and infrequent, and I worry her lungs are too withered to take it in. But then a gasp, and when I pull my hand away, the powder is almost half what it was. A long, painful moment before her next breath, which takes in the rest. There's nothing more I know to do but sit and listen to Sim's gasping, trying to suck down lungfuls of air and hope. I stare down at her, my hips over top hers, and my own breath ragged inside me. I've two fingers pressed to the pulse point on her wrist, braced for the moment it stops. A piece of snow caught in my hair melts and drops down my cheek. Beside me, Joanna has her eyes closed, hands clasped before her. She might be praying. And then Sim's breath starts to come easier. It still sounds like the gasping of someone who has been running, but it seems like less of a fight. Her pulse starts to slow, no longer working quite so hard to make up for the rest of her body failing. She blinks once, then her eyes slide closed as she takes a steady breath, a slip from unconsciousness into sleep. "What did you give her?" Joanna asks, her voice hoarse. "I don't know," I reply, my fist closing around the tiny vial, now empty in my hand. Maybe it's medicine. Maybe magic. Maybe it's enough for a woman to cross an ocean to find. Enough to give your life to the study of. Enough to kill for. When I let the vial fall, the sweat from my palm has transferred the inky symbol from the glass to my hand. 14. The waxwork woman, who introduces herself to us as Miss Quick, most certainly not an actual name, but I don't press, returns with a bucket of water and roots around the shop for the rest of my requested items. When she realizes I'm prepared to remove the glass shards with my bare hands, she offers a set of tongs the length of my palm from her kit.
"I only use them on the wax," she says,
but I still wash them before digging into Sim's arm. With the shards removed, I clean out the cuts and stitch them shut. Short of shredding Quick's blankets or my own bodice, there's nothing to use for bandages, so I unwrap the scarf from Sim's head and use that for bindings. Beneath it, her hair is coarse and cropped close to her head. When I'm finished, I push my spectacles up onto my forehead and press the heel of my hands against my eyes. They're stinging from doing such delicate work in poor light.
"Is she going to be all right?"
Quick asks from behind me. "I hope so," I reply. "She's no longer actively dying, which is a start." I toss the towel Quick offered into the bucket of water, now brown and murky with blood. "Are you two related?" I ask her, then realize what an ignorant question it was, as it's based entirely upon their shared skin color. "Or how do you know each other?" Quick laughs.
"We know each other in the way everyone who sails under the crown and cleaver does."
She pulls up her sleeve, revealing a landscape of raised brands and scars and thick, ropey veins. At the inside of her elbow, she has the same inked illustration of a crown and a blade, hers much cruder and more faded into her skin than Sim's, like she could have been born with it. "What's the crown and cleaver?" Joanna asks.
"A corsair fleet that makes berth in a fortress outside Algiers," Quick replies, "and with one of the largest holdings in the Mediterranean."
My throat goes dry. In spite of my early suspicions since I met Sim, corsair rings like a rock dropped into a bucket. Next to me, Joanna pales. "You're pirates?" she asks. "Both of you?"
"Only if you ask the Europeans," Quick replies.
"Are you a thief, too?" Joanna asks. "Just like her?"
"If all the thieves in Zurich were hung," Quick replies, "there'd be no one left."
"I'd be left," Joanna replies. Quick picks at something under her nail.
"Well, you're English, aren't you? You have the accent."
"How did Sim find you?" I ask.
"Her father has his people in every city, if you know where to look," Quick replies. "We watch out for each other if our paths cross. When she came to me, I put her up."
"So it's true, then," Joanna asks. "There is some kind of code among the pirates. Honor among thieves and all that." I had been preoccupied watching Sim's chest rise and fall with a steadier breath, but I realized suddenly what Quick has said. "Sorry, what? Her father? Who's her father?"
"Didn't she tell you?"
Quick picks up a handful of kindling from beside the stove and starts to pack it into the belly before reaching for a flint.
"She is the daughter of Murad al-Dajjar, his only daughter."
When Joanna and I are clearly less impressed by this name than expected, she qualifies,
"He is the commodore of the Crown and Cleaver fleet. Hundreds of men sail under his command."
The kindling catches, and Quick shuts the door of the stove with a clang.
"You want something to eat?"
"We're not part of your fleet," Joanna says. "You don't owe us anything." Quick shrugs.
"I like to help the less fortunate than me, and there aren't many."
Even with the stove lit, the workshop is bloody cold. A necessity, Quick tells us, or else the waxworks melt. Joanna helps her assemble turnips and potatoes for a stew as I watch over Sim, though my gaze drifts along the walls to the wax forms lining them. "What do you make them for?" I ask, unable to look away from a set of organs cast in wax, a heart, a set of lungs, and a stomach on stands.
"Some for curios,"
Quick replies.
"They have wax replicas of the royal family in England that move with clockwork, you know."
"Well, that will haunt my dreams," Joanna mutters.
"The Venuses are for medical schools,"
Quick says, pointing with the tip of her knife to the body I'm staring at.
"They commission them in Padua and Bologna and Bern and Paris, so they needn't cut open cadavers to teach their students what the inside of a person looks like."
I press my fingers to Sim's pulse point, an absent-minded monitoring. And it is a strange duet to feel that steady thump against my skin while looking at a perfect model of a human heart, veins and arteries and chambers exposed. How did you come to make waxworks if you were raised in a pirate fleet? Joanna asks, only a tiny bit of judgment bleeding into the word pirate.
The same way any African comes to Europe, Quick replies. The ship I served on was captured. My crew was enslaved. I was purchased by Herr Kraus, the waxmaster, and brought here to be trained.
I didn't know slavery was legal in Switzerland, I say. Quick halves an onion with a single neat cut.
It's legal. Everywhere there's money in the slave trade. And the bankers here have deep pockets.
Quick only has a single bowl for the stew, so we pass it among the three of us, handing the spoon back and forth, and sometimes fishing out chunks of potatoes and cabbage with our fingers when the others take too long. Outside, the storm batters the shop, the planks moaning and the stove rattling as the wind whips down the chimney. Strong weather can make even the safest place feel haunted. My clothes are still damp from the snow, and the soup is so hot it scalds my tongue, but I keep shoveling it down until I can't taste a thing. It just feels so good to be warm inside and full of food. I think of the crusty loaves of bread Callum would bake to pair with the winter stews that I learned to make using scraps from his pasty fillings. It was a process, and Callum put up with many nights of overly salted meat and broth so thick we had to chew it. Once, after a particularly miserable showing at venison and tomatoes, he said the bread deserved butter, and I said he also deserved butter than the stew I had given him. And though I generally find puns to be the lowest form of humour, I said it because I knew Callum would like it, and he laughed, the sound as warm and round as a fresh loaf. Maybe that was love? Who knows? Quick lets us sleep in the workshop that night while she takes the loft above the stairs. Herr Kraus, she assures us, left for Padua last week and isn't due to return until the end of the month. There are no windows in this workshop, and as the fire starts to die and the threat of putting out the lamp grows imminent, the pieces of wax assembled around the room seem to grow more ghoulish. Not threatening, but present, like statues of saints in a cathedral keeping a vigil. I check on Sim again before returning to Joanna, who is sitting with her mother's effects spread on the floor before her, her back to the stove and knees pulled up so that her skirt canyons between them. It is a most unladylike way to sit, and it reminds me of childhood. I crouch down across from her. Do you want to stay the night here, or go back to the boarding house? When she doesn't answer, I tap a finger against her shin. Joanna, she looks up. What did you find? She scrapes a hand through her hair, pushing a few errant strands out of her face. Other than those vials, there isn't much in the bag. Art supplies and toilette and a petrified piece of cheese. I glance at the leather folio lying untouched in front of her. What about the papers?
I haven't looked yet.
Why not?
Because what if she was working on something awful?
She presses her hand to her face.
What if she and Platt were conspiring? What if she's not who I thought she was? All my life, I was sure I could be whoever I wanted because my mother was herself in all things. But what if that was just an excuse for ugliness?
Then let her be ugly, I reply, because you're not her, and you're glorious.
Even though I like shoes and lace and anything brightly coloured?
She looks down at her hands, the fringe of her eyelashes casting smoky shadows down her cheeks.
Even though I'm not who you want me to be any more?
Of course she wasn't the same as she had been when we last parted. She was a brighter, polished version, silver purified in the belly of a crucible until it glinted star bright. Beside her, I felt stale and moulding and unchanged, because if I had not believed entirely in who I was and what I wanted, I'd never survive. Joanna had let the world change her, let the winds polish her edges and the rain wear her smooth. She was the same person I had known, had always known, just a version that was more completely her. "There's no one I'd rather you be," I reply. She runs her fingers along the edge of the folio, sucking her cheeks in, then carefully unwraps the string, binding it closed. The hard leather snaps at the release, and Joanna and I both peer inside. The folio is stuffed with papers, some bound together with twine, others loose and weathered. Joanna and I both reach in, scooping out a handful of scraps of notes and sketches and mathematical equations with their answers circled. I skim a few, trying to read the splotched, frantic hand and make sense of anything I'm seeing.
"Look here!"
Joanna pulls a single page from the folio, double the size of any of the others, and folded into quarters to fit inside. Joanna unfolds it. Then she and I both take an edge and hold it up to the lamplight. It's a map, though that's all I know to say of it. It's hand-drawn like all the other pages, but clearly meticulous, careful work. It is done in ink rather than pencil, thick, confident strokes, the sort one sits at a desk in good lighting and steadies their hands before beginning. There's the start of an intricate border around the edges, and a compass in one corner. A few places are splotched with colour, as though she hadn't time to finish filling it in. "Was your mother a cartographer?" I ask.
"I don't know, though she lived in Amsterdam for a time."
When I look back at her blankly, she clarifies.
"That's where all the best mapmakers are. What's it a map of, though?"
I fish my spectacles from my pocket and smash them onto my face, nearly poking myself in the eye as one of my hands is occupied keeping the paper in place.
"Look here, that's Algiers,"
I point, "and the Alboran Sea, so that's Spain. There's Gibraltar." I trace my fingers along the fine lines inked over the water, the paper puckered slightly where she had begun to watercolour.
"So what's this here?"
Joanna taps an island in the Atlantic, all the tides and current lines seemingly centering around it.
"I don't know.
I saw a fair number of maps of this area when I was travelling, but I've never seen that before.
It's very small.
Maybe too small for most cartographers to mark it."
"Or maybe that's what she's mapping," Joanna says. "Maybe whatever she was looking for or working on, perhaps it's there."
She glances up from the map.
"Do you think she knows?"
"Who?"
"Your sailor pirate friend, Sim."
"I think she knows something about it," I reply. "More than we do." Joanna presses her teeth into her bottom lip, her fingers tracing the dotted lines of the map.
"Maybe we could ask her."
"She may not tell us anything, even if she does know."
"But this is what she was looking for, isn't it? This map? She's a sailor, and she wasn't after my mother's paintbrushes. It's got to be this map. And if she wants it, she must know where it leads and why it's so valuable."
"So what are you saying?" I ask.
"I think we should stay here," Joanna says. "Frau Engel is paid for the night. She won't mind if we aren't sleeping in the bed so long as she has her coin. We can go tomorrow and get my things. But I don't..."
Her eyes dart over to Sim.
"We need to talk to her. Sims, I hope she'll talk to us."
Joanna falls asleep before me, curled around the stove with her mother's folio, carefully restuffed, for a pillow. I stay up for a while, sitting at the workbench, sort of watching Sim and sort of thinking about Sybil Glass's map and that shimmering powder. I'm tempted to make a quiet rummage through the bag for another look, but I resist. But I want to know more. I want to know what it is, and how it works, and why it saved Sim. When all my indignance over inequality, the plight of women in the world, and the education denied me is boiled away, what is always left is that wanting, hard and spare and alive, like a heart made of bone. I want to know all of it. I want to look at my own hands and know everything about the way they move beneath the skin, the fine strings that tie them to the rest of me, and all the other intricate components that fuse together to make up a complete person. The mysteries of how a system as delicate and precise as the human body not only exists, but exists in infinite variables. I want to know how things go wrong, how we break, and the best way to put ourselves back together. I want to know it all so badly it feels like a bird trapped inside my chest, throwing its body against my ribcage in search of the strong wind that will carry it out into the world. I would tear myself open if it meant setting it free. I want to know everything about my own self and never to have to rely on someone else to tell me the way I work. I think again of abandoning my hope of working with Platt, and where I have left to go from here, which, in short, is nowhere. No time to keep searching for schools, no money for apprenticeships, and not enough strength to hope that if I keep banging down doors, some day it will pay off. Not enough. The idea of working with Dr. Platt felt like my fingers scraping a star, but that flared out and faded into the darkness so fast. Or perhaps it exploded in my face and then laughed at me. That was more what it felt like. I don't know where to go from here. The panic caves inside me, like a paper curling in the grip of a flame. I do not know where to go. Across the room, Sim mumbles,
"Something's wrong with my arm."
I look up as she raises her head, blinking hard like she's still trying to rouse herself. I abandon my perch on the bench, already thumbing through possible complications. Gangrene, infection, pain, discoloring in the skin that signifies decreased blood flow. But she lets her head fall backwards so she's staring up at the ceiling and says,
"I think I cut it."
I stop on my knees next to her, then sit back on my heels. To put it mildly,
"I can't move my hand."
I'm not surprised. Are you feeling any pain?
"My ribs hurt," she says. "It's hard to breathe. Did I fall?"
"No, I think you were poisoned," I reply. "It entered your body through the cuts upon your arm. Based on your symptoms, I'd wager it's a paralytic that attacks the skeletal muscles."
"You're still here," she says, her eyes still fixed upon the ceiling. "Why are you still here?"
"I had nothing better to do." Her eyes flick over to me, her gaze more focused.
"You're being sarcastic."
"No, actually, I was being flippant. But I can do sarcastic, if you'd rather." I smooth my skirt against my knees with flat hands. "Best keep a close eye on your arm, though. There's still time for gangrene to set in, and I have never amputated a limb, so this would be a new experience for us both, and I can't imagine it would be as neat as the stitches. Embroidering pillows doesn't give you quite as much practice for amputations."
"You didn't have to help me," she says, her voice very soft.
It feels like such an absurd amendment to gratitude that I respond with vinegar before I can stop myself. "You're right, I didn't. Why didn't you tell me this a few hours ago? You would have saved me so much effort and worry." I expect she'll bristle, my hard edges once again knocking someone away. But instead she grins.
"I do like your sarcasm better."
I laugh in surprise. "Well, it is with entirely no sarcasm, which is hard for me, I assure you, that I say I stayed because I wanted to be certain you were all right."
"So why did Miss Hoffman stay?"
"Less noble reasons. Though, I assure you, she was concerned for you as well. Joanna wants to speak with you about her mother's work. I told her you may refuse, as you have a tendency to be stubborn and inscrutable."
"Inscrutable?
She lets out a short breath of laughter.
Coming from the prickliest girl I've ever known.
Prickly, I say. I'm not prickly.
Felicity Montague, you are a cactus.
Debatable. My knees are aching against the hard floor, so I stretch out on my stomach parallel to her, propping my chin on my hands. My botanical equivalent would more likely be... What are those plants that shrivel as soon as you touch them? I'd be one of those. She pulls herself over on her side with a wince, her good arm curling under her head.
Not something medicinal?
Perhaps, I say, though that's a rather obvious answer, isn't it? I stack my fists atop each other and rest my chin upon them. Or maybe I would be a flower, but a really tough flower.
A wild flower, Sim says, the kind that are strong enough to stand against the wind, rare and difficult to find and impossible to forget. Something men walk continents for a glimpse of.
I wrinkle my nose. I'd rather not be glimpsed by men. Perhaps we can set up some sort of trap so they can fall off a cliff if they try to pluck me from the ground. I stretch my hands out before me, making a study of my nails, which have grown long and filthy in our travels. Longer than I like to keep them, for practicality, though the thought makes me feel foolish. I'm not running a practice and being called upon daily to perform surgeries. It's a needless routine that suddenly feels silly and aspirational. But you're right. Whatever I am, there would likely be spines or thorns. They keep people away. Sim rolls onto her back again, her neck arching in a stretch.
I didn't think I'd see you again.
Sorry to disappoint you. She looks sideways at me.
It wasn't a disappointment.
Well, you wouldn't have, except that Joanna disappeared the morning of her wedding, and Dr. Platt recruited me to help find her in exchange for a job.
So you got what you wanted, then?
When I don't say anything, she prompts,
You're working for him.
I'm not. He's... I consider saying, conspiring to kidnap me, but am too tired to explain. So instead I finish, not what I expected. Sim does not seem moved. Her tone is the verbal equivalent of a shrug when she says,
So you'll find someone else to teach you medicine things.
It is nowhere near that simple.
Because he's your hero? She asks.
Because I've wanted to study with him for so long, I say. I've wanted to study, full stop.
Who's keeping you from that?
No one's keeping me from it, but I can't just read books forever. I want to work and learn and be taught by someone smarter than me. I want to help people, which I am not allowed to do because I am a woman. I sit up and dust off my elbows, cross that I let myself slip into familiar territory with Sim. For if I'm a cactus, she's a very argumentative rosebush, and I've drawn my own blood again by reaching out. Maybe I was foolish to let you seduce me away to Stuttgart and expect everything would miraculously fall into place for me. And maybe Alexander Platt wasn't what I expected, but it's not as though I have many chances to learn medicine.
Of course you don't, she says, pushing herself up on her good elbow. You're trying to play a game designed by men. You'll never win, because the deck is stacked and marked, and also... You've been blindfolded and set on fire. You can work hard and believe in yourself and be the smartest person in the room, and you'll still get beat by the boys who haven't 2 cents to rob together.
It's the sort of sentiment that kept me awake in Edinburgh, long nights of sleepless panic that I was wasting my time trying, that someday I would wake up and find I was old and had wasted my life trying to wage war armed with only a great deal of indignance, which is about as useful as a bowl of cold porridge in battle. But then Sim says,
So if you can't win the game, you have to cheat.
Cheat? I repeat.
You operate outside the walls they've built to fence you in. You rob them in the dark while they're drunk on spirits you offered them. Poison their waters and drink only wine. That's what Sybil Glass did.
The silence hangs between us, underscored by the last embers popping in the stove. From the shelves, wax ears eavesdrop.
I'll talk to you and Joanna tomorrow, Sim says suddenly, because you helped me, and because I want to see the map.
How do you know about the map?
It was a hope until you just confirmed it, so thank you.
Oh, I mean, what map? She rolls her eyes.
Are you going to keep a vigil over me while I sleep?
To make sure you don't steal the map? If there is a map.
I meant to make certain I don't die. But yes, let's keep trust at an arm's length.
She slides over on the pallet.
Come lie down with me. At least you'll be warm.
I hesitate, then lie down beside her and pull the quilt over both of us. She takes another deep breath with a steadying hand to her chest, then looks sideways at me and says,
Did I really seduce you to Germany?
Now it's my turn to roll my eyes, regretting I ever used the word. It was a combination of you and Alexander Platt. And look, now you're both the banes of my existence.
You need to be more discerning about who gets their talons in that brilliant brain of yours.
I snort, louder than I mean to. I'm not brilliant. She purses her lips with a soft humming sound.
You're right. Brilliant is quite a strong word. But you seem very bright. Or if not bright, you're at least confident. And often people can't tell those two things apart.
I don't feel confident. I feel like an actress, a pretender, someone who wears a brave face because the moment a strong-willed woman shows weakness, men will push their fingers into it and pry her apart like a pomegranate. But I don't correct her. I'm still afraid that the first chance she gets, she might crack me open too. 15. Sim, Joanna and I leave Quicks the next morning for a coffee shop down the road to take breakfast. In the wake of the storm, Zurich is cold and bright. A thin-fingered mist sits above the streets, making the frost sparkle and the stones emanate light. Even my breath, white as it strikes the cold air, seems to shine. Down the road, a pot clangs as it's slung over a cook fire. Chestnuts pop in a frying pan. A blacksmith's apprentice strikes his anvil, a call to his master that the forge is hot. A dog barks somewhere out of sight. I'm surprised Joanna doesn't go chasing after it. Women are barred from English coffee shops. Most institutions pride themselves on being havens for discourse and educated thought, though most of their clientele are men who slept through Cambridge regurgitating multisyllable words and proving they know who Machiavelli was. Here, the customers remind me more of the crowd that would frequent Callum's bake shop. Working class, quiet and polite. It's mostly men, but the sheet of rules posted beside the door makes no notations about sex. No one gives us a second glance. We pay our coins for breakfast and take a table farthest from the door beneath a notice board and a stuffed crocodile with his jaws wide. I can hardly taste my coffee after I so thoroughly scalded my mouth the night before on quick stew, but every swallow makes me feel warm and more awake. Joanna brought her mother's bag and the leather case. She keeps the bag pinned between her feet under the table and the case over her shoulder, even though it requires her to sit on only half the chair, and every time she shifts, it smacks the back of her head with a crack. Sim watches Joanna struggle, the corners of her mouth turning up.
Don't worry, I've only got one good arm now.
She tugs on the sling around her neck.
You could fend me off.
Joanna sighs with frustration, then reluctantly hangs the strap of the case over the back of her chair. I still don't trust you, she says, but Sim just shrugs in reply, unconcerned. We sit in silence for a long minute. Sim murmurs a prayer of Bismillah before she blows on her coffee through pursed lips, making the surface jump. I had expected she would be more reluctant to come with us, but thus far she's been suspiciously cooperative. I awoke this morning when she left our shared bed, certain she was running, but she was only rising to pray with Quick. She let me check her injured arm and tie the sling, then borrowed a scarf from Quick and wrapped her head again.
"So, who is going to speak first?" Sim says at last. "Or should we keep wasting time waiting on each other?"
Joanna and I look at each other. She doesn't say anything, just tips her head towards Sim, like I'm supposed to answer. Sim blows harder on her coffee. "All right, I'll start." I clear my throat. "Where did you meet Sybil Glass?" Joanna, who has been shredding a piece of cut meat between her fingers, startles and looks at Sim for the first time since we sat down.
"You knew my mother?"
Sim sets down her mug and cracks the knuckles of her good hand against the edge of the table.
"She was captured by my father's men when she was mapping in our waters."
"Mapping what?"
Joanna says. "She was an artist on a scientific expedition, not a cartographer."
"She was," Sim replies, "and on the side, she was mapping the nesting grounds of dragons."
"Dragons?" Joanna and I ask at the same time.
"Sea dragons," Sim clarifies. "The ones you Europeans draw upon charts for decoration. All the dragons that are left nest and swim within my father's waters, and we protect them. We keep invaders away from each other."
"My mother was not an invader," Joanna says.
"No," Sim agrees. "She wanted to study the dragons. She was making maps, tracking their migration patterns and trying to plot their nesting grounds. Not even my family knows that anymore. But my father was sure that any Europeans in our waters would mean extinction for the beasts and our fleet. She was alone, but she would bring more. He wanted her to destroy her map and agree not to take what she knew back to London. And she wouldn't."
"Did your father kill her?"
Joanna asks bluntly. I almost choke on my coffee.
"No," Sim replies. "But she died at his fortress. She was sick when we took her prisoner, but she refused our treatments because she was experimenting."
"What exactly was she experimenting with, if she was just making maps?" Joanna asks. "That seems like a very good story to cover up a murder."
"The dragon scales," Sim says. "They have a sort of... I'm not sure how to explain it. They elevate you."
"Literally?" I ask.
"No, not literally," she replies. "No one's flying. It's a stimulant."
She lets her hand fall into her lap.
"Sailors used to carry them on strings around their neck and chew them before a fight for strength. They were taken once a day to ward off illnesses. Your mother," she looks to Joanna, "was testing the properties on herself."
"Lots of doctors do that," I explain when Joanna still looks unconvinced. "If you can't find a willing subject to try a new medicine or procedure, you use yourself. John Hunter gave himself gonorrhea to test his theory about its transmission." Joanna wrinkles her nose, then looks back to Sim.
"If she was sick, and you didn't save her, you murdered her."
"She wouldn't take our help," Sim replies.
Her good hand is fisted upon the table.
"She said she had to complete an experiment. She would only take the scales as treatment."
"And you had them, and wouldn't give them to her?"
"My father has outlawed taking them in our holdings."
I can hear Sim grinding her teeth, and I'm tempted to put out a cautionary hand to Joanna. She has as much right as Sim to be angry, but Sim isn't using her emotions like a cudgel the way Joanna is.
"He won't let them on his ships, because you don't have to take them many times before it's all you can think about. And when you strip the scales off the backs of the dragons, they don't regrow. We didn't let her die. She let herself die.
Realization dawns suddenly upon me, and so I turn to Joanna. Let me see your mother's things.
What?
She snatches the bag up from under the table and presses it to her chest. Why? The vials. The ones we used yesterday, I say, flapping my fingers at her. Let me see them. Joanna roots around in the sack and comes up with the leather roll and unfurls it upon the tables. I unhook one of the remaining vials filled with the opalescent powder and hand it to Sim.
Is this them? The scales?
She uncorks the vial with her teeth and takes a careful sniff before dipping her pinky in and scrubbing it against her thumb.
I think so, though she didn't have any of this with her when I met her.
It would have been on her ship. This is what saved your life yesterday. It worked as an antidote against the poison. I unfold the other half of the leather skin so that the vials of labelled poisons are on display. If Sybil Glass was trying to create a compound made from the sea dragon scales that worked against poisons, it would explain why she had a bag full of venomous samples. She wasn't sick. She poisoned herself to test her theories. If Platt was on the expedition with her, do you think he knew about the dragons and the scales too? He's going back to the Barbary States. Maybe he's hoping to follow her maps and find the sea monsters.
And then he takes samples back, and all your English sailors come to my family's territory and kill our beasties and us with them, Sim murmurs.
She's still pressing those flakes of scale between her fingers, and I half expect her to touch them to her tongue. I wonder just how addictive it is. What if there were a way to duplicate the compound found in their scales, I say, something man-made and non-addictive that could be used medicinally? If it has anything close to the restorative powers we saw yesterday, it could help a lot of people.
But you'd first need the scales, Sim says, and my father would never allow it. Once these waters are open to Europeans, our fleet won't survive, particularly under its impending leadership.
You mean you? I ask. When she looks quizzically back at me, I prompt, I thought you were the legendary daughter of a legendary pirate king.
No one said legendary, she replies.
Quick did.
My father may be a legend, but I won't be.
Sim jabs her knife at her egg. The yolk breaks, spilling gold across her plate.
I am my father's oldest child, and I have claim to the crown and cleaver fleet when he dies. But he'd rather see his sons take up his title, because I'm a woman. He'll leave me something, because the law forces him to, but it will be half of what my brothers get, if that, and it will not be the fleet. I have spent my whole life fighting for what would be mine without question if I were a man, and to be better at it than my brothers, because women don't have to be men's equals to be considered contenders. They have to be better.
She slumps down in her seat, rubbing her injured arm.
That's the lie of it all. You have to be better to prove yourself worthy of being equal.
So this is how you cheat, I ask. You bring Sybil Glass's lost map to your father, and that wins you his favour.
And what do two English princesses want with maps that lead to monster nests? Sim challenges.
What my mother wanted, Joanna says, and her eyes are suddenly bright as new forged bronze, the same way they used to flash when we would collect samplings of plants from the countryside in hopes of discovering an unknown new species. Can you imagine the scientific advancements this could lead to? What else will we learn about the sea if we know about these creatures, and how they live, and what they eat, and how they hunt, and sleep, and everything? Why do you say English like we're all wicked? You're pirates. You're not exactly sinless.
But we don't come into your countries and drive you out, Sim says, worming her knife farther into her egg. That's what you do to us. You expect me to believe that just because your intentions are noble, all the English are, or all Europeans. The Imazin, who you would call the Berbers, she adds, have already fought wars over these creatures. We don't need to fight you too.
So what if we don't bring the English into it? I ask. Your father has ships and men at his disposal. What if you bring him the charts and the daughter of Sybil Glass? Not as a prisoner, I say quickly, for Joanna looks like she's ready to raise a sound protest to my phrasing, but as a companion, someone to work with, who wants to pick up where her mother left off in order to better understand them. Joanna wants an expedition. Why not ask Sim's pirate lord father to fund it? Sim frowns.
My father doesn't want another Sybil Glass. He doesn't want to make a study of the dragons, or their nests, or their scales, or any of it. He just wants to keep them undisturbed, and he wants the map to make sure others do too. That's what I went to Stuttgart for, to make certain that if it existed, it was returned to us.
Then we change his mind, I say. Protecting these creatures isn't the same as simply not destroying them. I know it's a risk, but we can make a case. Where do you come in? Joanna asks. I expect her to be looking at Sim, but instead she has her eyebrows raised at me. What about me? Man-made and non-addictive that could be used medicinally, she parrots. That sounds right up your street. You want to make a name for yourself in a way Platt never could? Make it yourself. I purse my lips against my mug, aware they're both watching me. I think of all the doors I've had slammed in my face. The fact that even when Platt had dreamed up a fictitious position to lure me to Zurich with him, the most he could imagine of me doing was paperwork. And even if that had been a real offer, what could I have done after? Who would I have to fight next to be permitted to go broke sitting in on lectures at a university where I would never be allowed to matriculate? And even if I did somehow walk out of the university with a degree in hand, would any English hospital employ me? Any patients seek my advice for anything other than midwifery or herbs? How long before the men came to chase me out of whatever corner I carved for myself? How much would I rather be in the company of this mad girl who loves creatures like Francis of Assisi, on Sim's boat, unfolding layers of scientific discovery? Finding knowledge that is not just new to me, but new to the world. It pimples the flesh along my arms to think of it. Though my heart has always been fixed to medical school like a compass point, that legitimacy necessary to prove my worth, this small shift in course may lead me somewhere entirely new, but perhaps still somewhere I want to go. When I answer, I worry it will feel like setting a dream on fire. I would go with you, I say, braced for it to sting. But it doesn't. It feels like the first step on a new continent. I look to Sim, and she looks to Joanna, and Joanna looks at me, and I realize that in that single moment, like a flash of heat lightning over a bare moor, all three of us are in control of our own futures, our own lives. Where we go now? Maybe for the first time. With my side pressed to Joanna's, and Sim's dark eyes meeting mine, I feel newer than I've ever been. Everyone has heard stories of women like us. Cautionary tales, morality plays, warnings of what will befall you if you are a girl too wild for the world, a girl who asks too many questions or wants too much, if you set off into the world alone. Everyone has heard stories of women like us. And now, we will make more of them. 16. The plan is thus. We will travel by all means available to the southern shore of France,
from where we can then take a ferry to Algiers. It's a pirate port, Sim tells us, overrun with buccaneers and smugglers, and without even a European toe stuck in for a foothold. But with Sim and that crown and cleaver upon her, she's certain no one will dare touch us. We will rally with her father's men in the city, who collect taxes from the European shipping companies, and they can take us to his fortress. Joanna has some coinage she digs up from her trunk at Frau Engel's before abandoning the rest of its contents and manages to secure some funds from an account of her uncle's. It's enough for the three of us to travel to the coast, though not well. Our journey's closest kin is the trek Monty, Percy and I undertook from Marseille to Barcelona. I expect that travelling with Joanna and Sim will be like trying to wrangle kittens into the bath, both of them with minds of their own and distrustful of each other. Joanna homesick and wanting to pet every dog we pass. Sim determined to do the opposite of any instructions given her, just to aggravate me. But to my great surprise, I end up being the dead weight of the trio. I'm always the first to call halt for the day, or ask to stop for a meal because I'm about to faint with hunger. The one who falls asleep in coaches and diligences and would have missed the stop had Sim or Joanna not woken me. Though even my lowest levels of competence are the equivalent of high functioning for most, and we are by far the most proficient trio I have travelled with to date. But I'm a bit rudderless without someone to boss around at all times. They are also both shockingly agreeable. Sim is quiet. Joanna speaks enough for all three of us. She's friendly with everyone we meet and seems to find a way to compliment every sour-faced cook or innkeeper on exactly the thing that softens them, and in such a sincere way that we are slipped steaming pastries and mugs of beer with no charge, and once booked on a diligence we were previously told was full and that we'd have to wait 3 days for the next. She makes us play word games as we travel, or tells us facts about animals, and makes us guess whether they're real or if she's made them up. Sim is better at the guessing, though when I contribute medical facts, they're both hapless. Joanna believes me for several confusing minutes that after my brother lost his ear, it grew back. I wrote to Monty before we left Zurich, informing him I was safe and in, if not good, at least neutral company, and that I would not be back in London as soon as I'd planned. I did not mention that there was a good chance I might be running off to join a pirate expedition to protect sea monsters. I have a sense that would get his britches in a twist. We leave European soil on a creaking ferry from Nice to Algiers. The boat departs at midnight, and is a far cry from even the utilitarian packet the Sim and I took from England to the continent. It seems to be built neither for cargo nor passengers, but is determined to shove as much of both as possible on board. The three of us end up on the top deck, the benefit of which is fresh air rather than the stale haze that swells on the lower decks, but that fresh air is bitter cold and thick with the misty spray of the sea. We huddle against the rail, with Joanna's cloak over our shoulders and mine wrapped around us from the front, tented in with as much warmth as our bodies can generate. The night is clear for the first time in days. The round belly of a not-quite-full moon sits low and bright over the water, sprinkled on all sides by stars. Every breath blazes warm and white against the night. As I watch the other passengers, it's hard not to notice that Joanna and I are some of the only fair-skinned Europeans aboard, and the three of us are some of the only women I can see. I have often been the only girl in the room, but I can't think of a time I was in the minority like this. It must be daunting for Sim to travel Europe, knowing that everywhere she goes, she won't be around people like her. Of course, I'd thought of this before, particularly while on the road with Percy. But there's something about being here, curled up on this deck with her and Joanna, that distills the loneliness of it for the first time. In that moment, the sky feels closer than home. Joanna falls asleep before we've left the port, her arms resting upon her knees and her face burrowed into them, leaving Sim and me alone with enough silence to fill the ocean. I had not realized how much space Joanna's bright, giddy presence took up among the three of us until she was snoring at my shoulder. Sim and I haven't spoken alone since Zurich, the night we slept side by side in the waxworks. Now, with the moon the colour of lamplight above us and her dark skin dewy with the sea spray, she looks softer than I've seen her. Her face seems less guarded, the hard set of her jaw swapped for parted lips. Her injured arm is still bandaged, but unslung and curled against her stomach.
"Do you think she's sad?"
Sim asks suddenly. "Joanna?" I ask, and Sim nods. "Seeing as she got her mother's things and escaped Platt, I can't see why she would be. Though I suppose she misses her dog."
"I mean, sad that she's not going to be married."
Since so much of our conversation lately has been about natural philosophy and sea monsters, this is not what I was expecting. A small part of me had even forgotten Joanna was engaged to begin with. This girl beside me felt worlds away from the one who had danced in her ridiculous costume the night of the Polterabend. But she's not, I remind myself. If given the chance, Joanna would likely chase sea monsters in that same indigo dress. "I don't think she's bothered by it," I say. "At least, she's not bothered she isn't being married to Platt."
"But if he'd been a good man and not a prick," Sim says, "it must be a shock to think your whole life is about to change and then..."
She flicks open her hand in wordless demonstration of the vanishing. I cut my hands over my mouth and blow on them for warmth. I think it would be a relief, actually.
"Wouldn't you like to be married?" she asks.
"Would you?" I counter.
"Someday."
"Really?"
"So long as I got along with him. It would be nice to have someone to grow old with. Someone to keep you warm."
I wrinkle my nose. I'd rather keep myself warm.
"What would you have instead of a husband, then?"
The curl of the moon looks back at me from her dark eyes.
"A giant dog like Joanna's?"
A cold wind rises off the water, and Sim presses closer to me, her cheek against my shoulder, so that when I speak, I can feel the material of her headscarf against my skin. "I think I want a house of my own," I start. The words a discovery as they leave my mouth. Something small, so I don't have much housework, but enough room for a proper library. I want a lot of books. And I wouldn't mind a good old dog to walk with me, and a bakery I go to every morning where they know my name.
"And you don't want anyone with you?"
Sim asks, raising her head.
"No family?"
"I want friends," I say. "Good friends that make up a different kind of family."
"That sounds lonely."
"It wouldn't be lonely," I reply. "I'd like to be on my own, but not alone."
"That's not the sort of lonely I meant."
"Oh." I'm not sure why I'm blushing, but I feel it swirl in my cheeks. "Well, that sort of aloneness doesn't feel lonely to me." Sim tips her head backward against the rail, the faint starlight reflected on her skin like seed pearls overturned from dark earth.
"You only say that because you've never been with anyone before."
"Have you?" I challenge.
"No, but I want to be."
"I don't think I do."
"How can you know that if you've never had anyone?"
"How do you know what you want?" I reply. "I've never drunk octopus ink, but I don't feel the need to, or like I'm missing anything in not having tasted it."
"But octopus ink might become your new favourite. Do not roll your eyes at me, Miss Montague."
She gives me a hard poke in the ribcage.
"Have you ever kissed anyone, at least?"
"Yes,"
anyone you liked.
Not with that emphasis. I have kissed men whose company I enjoyed.
And?
And? I make a gesture that looks